Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your unexpected, unbidden, and more or less unnecessary of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You ever just vibe? Just like be in a good mood, be open-hearted, feel the endless possibilities of the universe radiating both out of you and into you. That happens to me sometimes. You may be surprised to know that, but that does actually happen to me sometimes. This week's episode, I want to talk about a musician who has had that effect on me recently, and that is Beverly Glenn Copeland. You may have seen over the last maybe 18 months or 2 years, a resurgence of attention around Copeland. Copeland is, I guess, we would think of the music in terms of new age in the mid 80s. He also made folk records in the early 70s. He has a very, very rich and interesting personal story, but also plenty of people have rich and interesting personal stories. For me, the music that Beverly Glenn Copeland made, especially on Keyboard Fantasies, which is a record from 1986, I believe, is just, I don't know. It just shines. It's, you very rarely hear me tripped up for words on podcasts, but there is something just essential and centering about the music. And I felt like the story and the music are so kind of unusual and exceptional that I wanted to put together an episode. So here we are. We are going to talk first to Taja Cheek. Taja is an associate curator at MoMA PS1 who put on the first Beverly Glenn Copeland show in America a couple years ago. So we're going to talk to Taja about the backstory and the history behind that. And then we're going to talk to Mina Tavakoli, who wrote a very, very lovely long review of Keyboard Fantasies for Pitchfork about the context of the music and also its just raw emotional power, no Iggy Pop. So first of all, let's start off with Taja Cheek. Taja makes music as Lorraine, new album coming soon, Air Horn Sound, Fatigue, it's coming out soon, go cop that. Taja, hello, welcome.
Hey, hi, John.
Very happy to have you. Also, I should say, we actually go back. We met many, many years ago in like radically different context.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think I interviewed you.
Yes, let's tell the people, just like set the stage for, I don't even remember what year this was. It was like 2012 or something, 11?
2000, yeah, maybe even 2010.
Wow.
I know, very crazy. Sarah Marcus was in town.
Yes.
And she was promoting her new book and you were in town and I was working at the radio station
vibing.
At Yale.
I was
you were vibing.
I was just vibing at Yale.
And yeah, I honestly don't even remember the context of us meeting. I just remember you in this recording studio and then we were chatting about life and stayed in touch all this time.
Now, look at you, killing it on many fronts. And I'm psyched that you're on Popcast, reversing it. Now I get to interview you. Very, very, very big energy.
The tables are turned.
Real talk. So I knew I had to have you here because you brought Glenn to PS1 for, was it the first USA performance that he had done? Or a very early one, certainly. This was in 2019, correct?
Yes, 2019. It was the first ever performance, which is very wild. I still can't believe it actually happened.
It's very wild. I very rarely regret missing concerts as a person who's gone to far too many concerts in my life. Usually I regret going to concerts. This was the rare show that when I did not go, I was like, that stupid, bad, bad, overly cynical John. Mistake. You messed up. Okay. First of all, just set the scene a little bit for what that show was like. You gave us some audio. We're going to play a little audio later, but tell us a little bit about what the show was like before we kind of step back and get macro about Glenn Story. What was the show like? What was the energy like?
All the performances at PS1 at that point, or most of them, I should say, took place in a giant geodesic dome that we would build in the courtyard in the fall and take down for warm up in the summer. And so that performance with Glenn happened in there. We really kind of packed it as much as we could. There was one show. That's the way we were really doing things at that time. We didn't really have multiple performances. It's like one and done. So we showed two documentaries, one by CBC, one directed by Posey Dixon, an artist named Yata performed, who looks up to Glenn and has, you know, listened to their music a lot and is one of my favorite musicians. And then Glenn also performed a few songs, some older material, some newer material. There were a lot of tears. I don't think there was a dry eye in the dome. Yeah, it was a pretty, not to rub it in, John, but it was a pretty magical moment.
That's okay. Like every now, like, look, I carry some cynicism with me, and I will say that one of the really helpful things about Glenn's music is it cleanses me of cynicism, right?
Totally.
Like it's, you know, like that's just the way that this music functions. And I was short-sighted on that weekend not to realize that I would be healed by going to that show. So anyway, this episode is a rebuke to 2019. John, that's okay. We're circling back. We're getting healed in real time today. Tell me about your earliest exposure to Glenn's music. How did it get on your radar? And then talk about the process of knowing that you wanted to bring it to PS1 and actually put it on stage. How did it come to you first?
It was a text message from Kip Malone, who will text me periodically with music and not say very much, just kind of knowing it's the thing I needed to be listening to. And he texted me a link to Glenn's music, and I freaked out. I don't know how else to explain it. I just freaked out. I was like, why hadn't I known about this before? It was just the most visceral experience I've had to music in a very, very long time. And I think at that point, I was thinking through the upcoming season of Sunday Sessions, our performance program. And I was just like, I don't know what I have to do to make this happen, but I have to figure out something.
Kip, we should say, Kip from TV on the Radio, like very, very knowledgeable, wide-ranging musical knowledge base, like really, really in touch. But Kip being up on Glenn is different than loads of people being up on Glenn. You know, that's like some very early adopting stuff right there, early awareness stuff. Was stuff already being reissued at this point, or was it still not there yet when you were first trying to put this in motion?
It was. And, you know, by that point, Glenn had a booking agent, and I, you know, very naively wrote to them and was like, oh, so, you know, I'd love to figure something out. And like, you know, of course, Glenn really was just not trying to come to the US for so many reasons. And I was just like, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to do Glenfest, as other people I started talking to started calling it. We're going to do Glenfest without Glenn and find a way to do maybe a Skype conversation or something. I was like, this is too important. I eventually learned about the documentaries that were coming out, and I was like, we'll do a screening of the documentaries. We'll do something. But like this music, this person, this story is too important to not engage in some way.
So you're basically like, come hell or high water, we're doing something, even if Glenn's physical presence is not going to be a possibility. That was your initial take on it.
Exactly. And, you know, people were kind of telling me like it probably won't happen. Like Glenn is probably not going to come just because he was so vocal about not wanting to come to the U.S. for so many reasons. And I was like, you know what? I respect that. I'm obviously not going to push someone to do something they don't want to do, but we have to do something.
Yeah. And how did you then get it over the finish line where it all worked out the way that it did?
I started talking to the booking agent and got connected to his manager. And then I just started talking to all of these people who were connected to Glenn in all of these different ways. It's been described as the Glennergy, that Glenn just radiates all of this energy outwards and it just becomes like a spiral of a love fest. And I definitely got swept up into that. It sounds very woo-woo, but it just is what it is. It is the Glennergy. And so I started talking to the directors of the documentaries and they were recommending other people for me to talk to and put this together and really kind of make it the right ode to Glenn's life and work and music. And eventually at a certain point, Glenn was just kind of like, well, if you're going to go through all of this trouble, I guess I'll show up. And we spoke on Skype and that was that. He was just like, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to come. And then we just started planning for that.
Can you help contextualize Glenn's music? So we know originally the kind of music in the early 70s, before the keyboard fantasies era, the early 70s, these were folk records. But then Glenn kind of receded from the music making world, took on television jobs. Can you talk a little bit about that backstory before we arrive at the kind of reemergence in the mid 80s?
Glenn was an actor on a Canadian children's television show called Mr. Dress Up. And that was a vessel for a lot of Glenn's songwriting for a long time. And it's just so interesting thinking about like musicians that we place in a very specific kind of context that also have a whole other life as children's musicians or art or making art with children also. But I think Glenn did that for something like 25 years. It was a very big part of his life.
So the way that we've even arrived at this kind of keyboard fantasies long arc of reevaluation and re-embrace is there was a Japanese record collector who basically cold emailed Glenn, if I'm not mistaken, and said, do you have any old tapes? That seems to be what happened. Is that accurate?
Yeah, exactly. A collector named Ryota Masuko found a cassette tape of Keyboard Fantasies, wrote an email and was like, hey, I'm interested in this. There's an interesting moment in the CBC documentary where Glenn and Ryota actually meet for the first time. And it's pretty amazing. I think I actually talked to Michelle Mama right before she made this trip. So I kind of also caught everyone at an interesting moment in the sort of reconciling of this story and this history as I was putting together the performance for PS1.
I mean, it really is a testament to the power of just like how one person can kind of set like, you know, 10 dominoes in motion to end up with where we are, like talking about it on podcast, you know?
Yeah.
So from what I understand, the collector bought up a whole bunch of the tapes and then sent the tapes to a variety of folks, you know, who run record labels, who are musicians, so on and so forth. And that leads to the interest in the reissues, which then, of course, leads to the interest from other musicians, which then leads to the show that you did, which then so on and so forth. That's really the domino point, because some of these Glenn records were selling on the secondhand market for hundreds and hundreds of dollars because there really weren't very many copies of them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It really starts with Ryota.
Certainly, as we get into the 80s and, you know, the Keyboard Fantasies era, that was almost, you want to say like a private pursuit, like a maybe potentially like a little bit of a quixotic pursuit, like maybe pressed up a few hundred cassettes, kind of just not making it with the intentionality of here's my big reentry into the popular music world, right? It sort of was more a personal project almost.
When I've spoken to Glenn about it, what I've gotten from him is more that people didn't really understand what he was doing. They just really didn't understand. They're like, who are you? What is this music? How do I place that? So I don't think it was the sort of thing where he was trying to be insular about it. I think that was just a byproduct of him not finding the right people at the right time. It's very interesting too. I think this happened, they talk about this in the documentary also, but he says that he always kind of knew that he would find an audience and find his people later in life. And that was something that was always kind of present for him. And that was something that had been told to him by spiritual guides and other people. So yeah, it's funny. I guess it's definitely come true in a way.
With that in mind, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what it means to rediscover something, because that implies that it was either never discovered in the first place, or it was kind of like cast aside or overlooked. So Glenn was of the mind, you saying, that people were just not ready, didn't have the capacity for what he was doing.
Totally. When we've talked about it, we talked a lot about Nina Simone, for example, as a kind of like analog to that, of just like someone who's blurring all of these genres, and the audience just wasn't ready at the time. But there's such a resurgence of ambient music, and there's so much more of a language and presence for that, which is really such a reduction for what Glenn does, but also fits in certain ways. It's just so ripe. And a language around, new languages around gender, new languages around so many other things that really just converged at a beautiful moment for Glenn to shine.
It's interesting because I do think the reassessment or re-embrace of this music that Glenn made, yeah, partially it's about this kind of like resurgent interest in whether it's ambient or new age or however you want to kind of like come at it. It's partially about that. But I do think so much of it is about increasing language and knowledge and visibility about identity and openness. And I think there's something that Glenn said in one of the interviews, I'm blanking on which one that he gave. He gave a few over the last few years about the audience finally being there. It's like the music was always here. Now the audience is here. And that notion that you might make something in your lifetime, but the audience is not there in your lifetime, or not there in the moment. Obviously, Glenn is still very much with us, but it's not there in the moment in which you put out your art. But that at some point in the future, that audience will emerge and the art will just be there waiting for them.
I think it's also racialized in a lot of ways, too, where people look at Black musicians and they expect it to look or sound a certain way, or the ways that we're expected to talk about Black music. Or, you know, I think about the ways that like hip hop is shortchanged as an experimental genre a lot, and what that means and how that also fits into someone like Glenn. You know, it's deceivingly simple music, but is really borrowing from so much and doing a lot of different things that people just didn't have language for then, and maybe have more openness to now.
Keyboard Fantasies just got properly reissued recently. There's the Transmissions compilation release. There's a lot of stuff on Spotify, weirdly, a lot of stuff on Spotify now. What is it that you hear? What really glommed onto you from hearing Glenn's music? What do you take away from it? What do you think it reveals that is so moving, that really left people in tears, you know, in the dome?
It's the voice. It's really incredible. Glenn's voice is still entirely there. You hear so much in it and you feel so much in it. Hearing him in the dome reminded me of the first time hearing him singing on the records. It's just like an indescribable feeling of every possible emotion bursting at the same time. You know, it's always interesting hearing musicians over the course of their career and hearing the ways that their playing changes or their voice changes or their musicality changes, but it feels like a more alive version of the records to me in a way that's just really deeply, deeply moving.
Okay, so you've heard this one 1,000 times already today, but we'll do it one more time for you. This is called Ever New.
Has been this resurgence of interest, which we've been talking about, and also just this kind of gift of all this music that was kind of trapped on obscure dead formats, right? And now it's all back. Now it's all back in easily accessible places. Is there something about this music that is resonating now in a way that maybe it wouldn't have 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago? Is there a reason right now that people are, forgive me for being goofy, but like vibrating on this frequency?
Well, I think it's because Glenn's story and Glenn's music resonates with so much that we're thinking about right now. Conversations around healing, conversations around gender, conversations around race, conversations around age. Just so much of it is there. And I think Glenn is just a really easy person to root for because, you know, as you were saying earlier about the sincerity really just kind of rings through. It's a time when people are deeply cynical about a lot of things with a lot of good reason, you know? And this is one thing that's really hard to be cynical about.
Of all the albums, which of the albums kind of speaks most loudly to you?
Oh, man. I mean, I think I've listened to Keyboard Fantasies the most, probably. That's the one I kind of always come back to, but it depends on where I am. But for now, I'll say Keyboard Fantasies.
You mentioned, obviously, musicians taking influence from what Glenn has put in the world. Where do you see those tributaries of influence starting to grow? Do you see, especially now that the music is more accessible, it's not simply a secret that gets texted from friend to friend. Do you start to see more of those tributaries of influence happening?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was one really interesting moment or series of moments at the show at PS1 is just kind of looking around the room and seeing who was there and also just seeing the ways that that obviously PS1 is a contemporary art organization. So, you know, there's a lot of visual artists there too, but just seeing the ways that it kind of traverses all different kinds of art, not just music.
You're saying in the audience there were musicians, visual artists, like folks coming from all the disciplines ready to have their hearts ripped open, kind of.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's going to be one of those things that's like, you know, like the sort of the tiresome thing that people say about the Velvet Underground, which is that, you know, it sold 500 copies, but everybody went and started a band. Maybe like 10 years from now, we will do like the oral history of who was in the audience at that show and then what they carried with them out into the world and then put out where they took that influence and what they did with it. Maybe we'll have to do that project on an anniversary.
I would love to do that.
Seriously, because I can only imagine, again, my frustration in not being there, but I can only imagine the people who made sure that they were there. Like, if you're dead serious about it, then I know you're going to find somewhere to put that in your art or your music or your writing or whatnot. Like, I believe that for sure. Is there a deep cut that you want to leave us with as we go out? Is there like look, they're all deep cuts, right? But is there a potentially slightly deeper or less heralded Glenn song that you'd like to make sure people hear?
That's a good question. I don't know. I guess in the spirit of Glenn, I would have to say the new work would be the deepest cut because Glenn, I feel like, still feels like he has so much left to do and really wants to be making work with string ensembles and just have so much enthusiasm for creating left. So I would say like not getting hung up on the older material, but like also making room for the new work too.
So would that be Lucky?
Yeah.
Let's listen to Lucky. This is Jesse Futterman, maybe Futterman, with Glenn. There's also a Peaking Lights remix, but let's listen to the original. And Taja, thank you so much for coming.
Yes, thank you, John.
Looking to sell your car? Carvana makes it easy. Enter your license plate or VIN, answer a few quick questions, and you can get a real offer that is good for 7 days in just minutes. That's not all. Carvana is dedicated to making car selling easy. No need to get up. Carvana will pick up your car from your home after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to sell your car without ever leaving the comfort of home.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Okay, so look, Mina Tavakoli is here. If you're not reading Mina, you're effing up. Let's just keep it a buck. You're effing up. Mina writes for Pitchfork, the Washington Post, other places. Mina wrote about keyboard fantasies for Pitchfork Sunday Review, also wrote a great piece about the Pure Moods compilation. We'll probably chat about that a little bit later. Mina, calling in from the central East Coast of the United States. Hello. Welcome to the podcast.
John, hi. You didn't need to do that.
Yeah, I did. Nah, it's true. Nah, I definitely did. Mina, the critic laureate of New Age reassessment, where did you first encounter Glenn's music? How did it arrive to you? Did you actively go and seek it out? Are you always on the radar for cassette-only New Age curios from the mid-80s? How does that energy land in your ears?
First off, the album has something patently precious about it. And I mean precious to mean rare and valuable, something worth protecting, not precious like twee. And I think anecdotally, a predominant sensation with this album is that it's almost designed to be shared with those that you find precious, with someone you love, a lover, a friend. And I think my introduction came from a blend of the latter two. I was lucky enough that it came from the perfect place, from someone who's in the hunt, a collector of these sorts of rare gifts.
Okay, so it was provided to you as a conspiratorial gift, kind of.
Exactly. I think for people who are a couple steps above a casual music fan, you know, people who are collectors, who make music, who write about it, who write it, just who are more active in the hunt for music than the average person, there's a sort of mist that hangs around a certain type of album, and I think this album is certified misty.
This is the thrust of the conversation around rediscoveries. Are we rediscovering something that was there and was either not paid significant attention to, potentially maligned, or at minimum cast off or overlooked? Or are we currently in search of something? And with this album, with Keyboard Fantasies, I mean, all of the Beverly Glenn Copeland stuff, but with Keyboard Fantasies, I sometimes wonder if it's actually leaning a little bit more to the latter of being in search of something beatific, something open-hearted, something that feels truer, purer, more aimed at an internal spirit than whatever it is we're getting day in, day out. And I'm by no means a pessimist about what we get in the contemporary space, but I do think that there are people who make that distinction or who want to emphasize that distinction maybe more than I do, and for whom a record like this would hold that level of meaning. To me, I feel like it's answering a call that certain people are feeling in the modern condition as much as it is beautiful on its own. That's how it registers for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think a funny testament to that is the fact that, you know, when we discovered or when sort of popular discovery of Glenn Copeland came up, he was referred to as an outsider artist quite a few times. And an outsider, out the gate, it sounds like a pretty natural thing to call him. In sort of like the art history sense, outsider art, quote unquote, is sort of a term that you give to work that's, for lack of a better word, naive or seen as unknowing of its own power, or it acknowledges maybe the artist didn't have formal training, or it's unpretentious in some sort of nebulous way.
Shout out Raw Vision Magazine number one. Shout out Raw Vision. And shout out the Outsider Art Fair, which I am a regular attendee of. I have a couple pieces here in the home office that I picked up at the Outsider Art Fair. So, yes, we're very familiar. Please continue.
No, no problem. But I think ladling that term onto pieces, I think most often is given to those who work in isolation, who don't have a profit motive, or in many, many cases, sort of marginalized out the gate by their own identities. You know, if they're poor, they're of a marginalized community, they're queer, they're non-white. Without being pessimistic as well, I think Glenn Copeland satisfies this idea. But we can talk about the things that challenge why I don't think he's exactly outsider at all.
Because you did mention this in your piece, but again, I think I agree with you that language is not sufficient or not accurate, perhaps. You feel like that framework was applied to him and then you want to reject and push against it, correct?
I think that's about right.
What is it that you think is insufficient or inaccurate about that language?
Well, I think first off, Glenn Copeland is formally trained. This is a formally trained person who is 15th century German Lieder music. This is like something that people get PhDs in. This is a person who is thoroughly knowing of sort of like the spirit of their work. I don't know if I would apply the term outsider to someone who went to school for it, to higher education for it.
Fair. And also, I think came from an academic family, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yeah.
So do you think that people were using the term outsider specifically because of the content and sonic approach of the music, or because of identity issues when people went back to rediscover more about Glenn? Was it more because of the identity issues at play?
The overdue appreciation of people who weren't in canons to begin with and are now sort of posthumously reappraised as definitely being like integral or essential to canons, I think is something that people are very fascinated and interested in. I think wondering openly about Glenn's introduction into like the modern music discussion has made me value him a little more constructively. It asks, you know, why him, why now? And I think it's just a number of forces that fall down to it. It's destiny. It's the fact that the wellness industry and the self-care industrial complex has made it so that New Age is now super en vogue. No small part to his journey of self-discovery as a transgender man. And we're also at a stage where I think culturally we're very invested in shifting marginalized figures from the fringe to the center.
And also, to pivot back, something very specific about the tone, texture, the pulse of this record. I've listened to plenty of quote-unquote New Age music, you know. I don't want to start playing like Andreas Vollerwinder songs, although maybe we will drop an Andreas Vollerwinder song right now. Who knows? It's up to Pedro. But plenty of New Age over the years. Something about this, forgive me and forgive SZA, I hope you'll forgive me. Something about this hits different than that. There is this framing of the childlike presentation, which I think comes up in a lot of descriptions. To me, I feel like whatever that is feels like an invitation. There's something womb-like about it. There's something swaddling about it. When I hear it, it feels like an open door to participate in whatever the energy is. It and again, these are like maybe lightly goofy ways to describe sonic experiences, but I think I've run out of all the other ways, to be honest. So here we are.
I think I said something even goofier, even stupider in my article. I think I said,
thank you for acknowledging that what I just said was stupid, first of all. Thank you for that.
It was an invitation. But, you know, I said, you know, if we emerged from the primordial soup with keyboards in hand, keyboard fantasies is what our first tribal lullabies would sound like. And I think there is something that feels so spare, so clearly the product of noodling around on a keyboard and creating something that doesn't seem far off from cradle song or nursery music. And I think there are a couple of fun thematic elements that you can sniff out that can help sort of like underscore this feeling.
Speak on it. bring it to the fore. Talk about those thematic elements.
First, there's science fiction. Do you sniff out a little bit of science fiction in this?
Maybe in the least fictive way, if that makes any sense.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't feel, it's science fiction that doesn't feel like fiction.
Totally. So Glenn totally loved Isaac Asimov, the writer. And I feel like there's a, you know, there's a lovingly extraterrestrial essence in here. Copeland talks about how Asimov gave him a lot of solace earlier in his life. And I quoted this bit that he introduced a short story collection by the pioneering writer Octavia Butler. And he said that science fiction is committed neither to marvels nor disasters. It deals with possible situations. And I like to think that this approach to sci-fi is like utterly right for Glenn. It's about plausibility over impossibility. You know, these aren't dramatic, pulpy visions of sci-fi. We're not talking about radioactive slime or octopi or anything like that. We're talking about tender songs that sort of pose like, what if?
These are songs about birth. They're not about death, and they're not about even the kind of troubled parts of living. They feel like they are about potential. They are about discovery. And that is a combination of what's happening with the singing, where they're singing, and the instrumentation. But to me, maybe that's why I think about these songs accessing something in us in terms of wanting to shed away or seek new potential, to feel the possibility of new life. Maybe that's kind of the bridge between what I was saying earlier and where we are now. That's why this music is hitting so specific at this moment. Throwing it out there.
I'm totally with you. I mean, I think the what if is like for us to extrapolate and to sort of graft onto whatever framework that you see applicable. I think for Glenn, if you want to follow the narrative of his movement from privately then publicly articulating himself as a trans man, I don't think putting this album as a sort of metaphor for that would be out of the realm of possibility. I don't think the quandaries of trans identity are for me to speak on. But, you know, in my article, I did call upon a writer named Andrea Long Chu, who's done a lot of excellent work explaining the destabilizing feelings of transness. And she calls it, in a really beautiful way, hunger without appetite is sort of an achievable but just out of reach reality. And I think there's a lot of what if inherently built into that schema. And I think tying that to keyboard fantasies is not unreasonable. The day
meets the dawn. He said something to the effect of, you know, the music was here, was just waiting for you, which is to say this generation of young people, this generation of open-minded people. The music was here, was just waiting to be reactivated in a sense by this wave. And I thought that was a really potent idea. I mean, you can think about it in the context of an item of clothing or a film or, you know, an idea in a piece of visual art. It may not be designed or intended, is maybe not exactly the right way to think of it, but it may be best suited to impact people at a later date.
I love thinking about albums that are like the phrase ahead of their time. It sort of like has that idea built into it. It's like, you need the rest of the world to mature a bit in sensibility in order to catch up to it fully. When you think of the albums that set, I don't know if there's an album that comes to mind that sort of satisfies this or sort of bears this title for you, something that's ahead of its time. But I wonder what we might be missing today. You know, like, is it possible for there to be a 19-year-old in Illinois producing like the sharpest, most forward-thinking chiptune that we can't even conceive of? Like, will his work be erased until close to or after his death? Or, you know, because of the flatness of the way that music works now, and is likely not going to be an album collecting dust in his basement, but it's probably going to be a link on his SoundCloud or Bandcamp. Will that sort of thrill exist any longer?
I think a broader swath of things are activating people in the moment, which is to say that the person that you're describing, it's probably not functioning in as total obscurity as Copeland was in the 80s, or certainly in the 70s, before the kind of New Age era, in the OG folk era. But I think that the paths to recovery, first of all, there's more of them now, and rediscovery and recovery of ideas and sounds is a much more complicated and polyvalent thing than it was even 5 or 10 years ago. So the odds of someone completely disappearing into obscurity only to be like yanked back 10, 20, 30 years from now, that arc feels like residue of the 70s, 80s into the 2010s. Even this Copeland story to some degree feels like something we would have talked about 5 or 10 years ago, like, oh, this crazy rediscovery. I kind of feel like we've done most of the rediscoveries maybe from that era. That's maybe I'm being a little glib, but I do think that, whereas I don't think we'll think of rediscovery the same way in 2030 or 2040. I think there will be a steady low hum that maybe we will tune into, but it will have always kind of been humming.
Also, the things that sort of rise to the top of the fact that Beverly Glenn Copeland is on Popcast is like, you know, like ascendancy. But to like
that's
the
it. No more. That's it. It's done. It's over.
Well, I'm talking about like a sort of like a major, you know, something worthy of discussion. The sort of like a phenomenon of a figure who is laying dormant, more or less, and is now sort of artifact we can stare at from a number of angles.
Or maybe I just want to feel something.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Could just be that. If we think about keyboard fantasies in the mid-80s, and then you have also written about this kind of commercial zeitgeist eruption of a new age industrial moment in the early to mid-90s when you wrote about the Pure Moods compilation, I wonder if you think that there is any linkage or dialogue between what he was doing in the mid-80s and what ends up becoming this kind of like universally eyebrow arch cultural moment 7 or 8 years later.
Pure Moods was this extraordinarily ridiculous album born out of some of the best performing work in Virgin Records' catalog. The beauty of Pure Moods, which has this incredible infomercial associated with it, was that it was an utter surprise, and it was compounded of surprises. Richard Branson, who was the CEO of Virgin at the time, even titled his agency Virgin to sort of recognize his inexperience in the music world. And Pure Moods represents a strong slice of Virgin backtracks that hit incredible, baffling success. I'm not entirely sure if I can diagnose why the constituent parts of the album, and by proxy, what made Pure Moods as a whole sell so well. But if I can guess, it has to do with the fact that these sorts of artists and these sorts of sounds are sort of meant to soothe, dispel drama, anxiety, and violence, and instead replace those ideas with a sense of inner peace. It's supposed to be a balm for the quotidian. It's supposed to provide an accessible, and in this case, commercial, saleable, and commodified sort of rapture.
I lived through this era of pop music and this infomercial. When I watch the commercial again, linked in your piece, it's almost like I can replay it in my head from memory. You know, certainly all the sonic adjustments and shifts. I'm looking at the list right now, the track listing, Enigma, Heavy, Enya, obviously Major, Orinoco Flow, Chariots of Fire soundtrack, Tubular Bells, The Orb. Weirdly, maybe the first time I ever heard The Orb was in this context, which says not great things about me. Ryuichi Sakamoto, a favorite of my mother's. Brian Eno, who maybe didn't know that he was licensing his music to this compilation. Perhaps a distributor did that on his behalf. There was something about the interior orchestral grandeur of a lot of this music that it had a like a tragic excess that maybe felt right for the time period. But also, I genuinely have no idea what I'm talking about. I just know that this commercial and this album was like way more influential than people tend to think it was.
Maybe there was something in the water, something about exploring a depth inside of you that you maybe didn't recognize. Maybe for the first time people felt this sort of yearning. Frankly, not unlike other music, the best new age music has a really pure purpose, sort of rejection of social values like irony or the pursuit of constantly working. And it's got an unwillingness to bend to conventional authorities. It says you are your own master. It's anti-establishment in that way. It's renegade music, but for really centered renegades.
But even describing this, it's like, I feel like D-pop Y2K goths should actually low-key be into Enigma. Like, I'd like to see a pivot from Y2K goth hacker .net aesthetics. I'd like to pivot to 1993-94 robed church goth energy, like kind of like Skinny Puppy, but at the church. I'd like to see If any Depop sellers are out there listening, I would like to see more of that. That would really cheer me.
The thing we're both groping so hard to get at is that there's, you know, something about like inhabiting an aesthetic that says that you can change yourself. Pure Moods tried to sell music's ability to make you a more centered, a more miraculous, a more calm version of yourself. It says that you're going to feel good for having listened to it. There is something pure in that offer, in the same way that like inhabiting Y2K aesthetics gives you sort of like edge and an in-group and an out-group idea of like, I'm on the internet, you know? I think this also does a similar thing. And, you know, you're seeing traces of it in sort of the Goop industrial complex and the self-care industry, where it says, you know, relax, you're sort of at the center of your own consciousness, you're in control. And I think this sort of does the same thing, or at least it did the same thing. And right now you can look back on it and be like, damn, this was goofy, but it was a pure effort.
Before we go, just circle back to Glenn for a minute. The world that is suggested on Keyboard Fantasies, the possibilities, the emotional openness, do you feel that listening to it, allowing yourself to be a part of it, to be inside of it contemporarily, is it a nourishing experience? Is it an escape? Is it a toolkit for tomorrow? How do you receive it now? Do they talk like this on NPR? I have no idea what's happening here. How do they talk in these other places?
No. I think that's a entirely, you know, fresherian question.
Damn.
Personally, the way I interpret it is that we talked about childlike for a second back there, but I think it reminds me of children's music. And there's obviously like pop sensibilities in children's music. It's designed to get stuck in your head, but they're supposed to be instructive. They're supposed to nurture or heal or soothe or teach. And so they impart that feeling, no doubt. But also, you know how lullabies and children's music can sometimes make you feel like crying?
Yeah.
This does that too. You know, I think it's the same feeling you get when you look at a stuffed animal in a shop window.
Like just like leaning kind of slightly up against the glass, tragically, like both
sun-bleached,
full of potential for joy, but also trapped.
It's that pathos pang. And I think these songs are very good at doing that. They're a potent medicine. Sometimes I have to ration how often I listen to them.
How much is that pathos in the window? Only Mina Tavakoli knows. Thank you for calling in and chatting about the infinite possibilities of Keyboard Fantasies and life with us.
No problem.
That is our show. I hope you feel emboldened to be your purest, brightest, happiest self. Please email me, popcastnytimes.com. Tell me if you are on board with this. Get on the Facebook group. Subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio content for more of that. All the other things I normally say seem silly right now because we are all basking in this incredible light. Thank you to Mina. Thank you to Taja. Thank you to our producer, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's go out with Sunset Village by Beverly Glenn Copeland.